From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Today, we remember the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We take a look at the six-lane boulevard named after him that loops around downtown Baltimore. Does it reflect the values Dr. King represented? We discuss it with two transportation experts. Then we talk with longtime activist and co-founder of the Jonah House community, Elizabeth McAllister, about her decades of activism using nonviolence and peaceful resistance. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Resick reviews Other Desert Cities, now up at the Fells Point Corner Theater. And a year after Dr. King's death, his widow, Coretta Scott King, visited Baltimore to support the 1199 SEIU Health Workers Union, which was organizing for higher wages at Johns Hopkins Hospital. We hear from two union members who recall that day. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. And this is a man named Lonnie.
Right now, we're on Martin Luther King Boulevard, McCullough Street. We just got a two-lane street on both sides going up and down. There's grass grown in the middle. Is it a store spot because it belonged to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? God rest his soul. And like every time I cross this street, like I just think about the man that he was and try to be like the man that he is.
You might drive down Baltimore's Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard every day, and unless there's a traffic snarl, not give it much thought. Today, on a day when we take time to remember the legacy of Dr. King, we're taking a look at the Baltimore Boulevard that bears his name. With me to talk about how the boulevard came to be and how it unites and divides the city is Celeste Chavis, an assistant professor in the Transportation and Urban Infrastructure Studies Department in the Morgan State University School of Engineering. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also with us is Gerald Neely, a former transportation planner in the Baltimore City Department of Planning. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard was opened to traffic a generation ago in late 1982. While it was being constructed, it was known as Harbor City Boulevard, but its name was changed by the General Assembly to honor Dr. King. It is very wide, six through lanes, plus left turn lanes and in some spots right turn lanes. Gerald Neely, what was there before MLK Jr. Boulevard?
A big condemned swath was there for quite a few years. It was originally supposed to be a full-fledged expressway, so they condemned a whole lot more than they really needed, and then they put in a surface boulevard to fill the void.
But it was essentially a residential area, or was there a street there?
Yes, there were small streets there. Fremont Avenue to the south, Myrtle Street in the north-south section, and then Biddle Street in the part up by McCullough.
And what was the thinking behind the boulevard?
They had condemned it for an expressway back when Baltimore was considering this, you know, huge, full-fledged, comprehensive expressway system. And then piece by piece, that expressway system got killed, and it left all this vacant land in its void. So you can think of Martin Luther King Boulevard as sort of an expressway light kind
of thing. So moving cars is basically the philosophy behind it. Professor Chavis, how does a broad boulevard like MLK affect the communities around it?
Well, I think the MLK Boulevard is kind of serving as a bisector between West Baltimore and the downtown area, simply because of how fast the cars are moving and the volume of cars. Uh-huh. So it makes it pretty difficult for anybody using a different mode, such as pedestrians, to go between them. So essentially, it cuts the two communities, and that bridge is kind of broken.
And how does that affect the communities, do you think?
I think it affects particularly the West Baltimore community because it's not seeing the same growth that we've been seeing in the downtown area. And so it becomes, you basically have to kind of revitalize the two communities separately since there's not really that interconnection between the two due to the fast-moving vehicles.
Gerald Neely, you're nodding your head. You agree?
I agree completely. I would just add that the sheer width of the road is a major factor. It isn't just the volume of traffic. It's how far you have to go in order to walk across the road and how long you have to wait for the traffic lights to change.
So it's not that there are not places to cross.
Yeah. It's just that you have to wait a long time.
Yes, there are also, especially in the northern section, there aren't enough places to cross as well. Between McCullough and Pennsylvania Avenue, it's a very long stretch without a crossing. That creates these big border vacuums between the communities and downtown, as Celeste just said.
Professor Chavis, as you said, it divides downtown from West Baltimore. How could it be redeveloped, in your view, to fit better into the city around it?
Well, one of the interesting things I think about the quarter is it is so wide, so there is a lot of land that could kind of be repurposed in a way. You have the really large median, and from what I believe also on the side of the road, like the sidewalk space is pretty wide. So it does allow engineers, planners some flexibility when it comes to redesigning the corridor. So some things that have been done is trying to have more of what's called a complete street. And what that means is you're trying to design the street for more than just the car. So you're designing the street for all users who would be on it, whether they're pedestrians, in their car, in transit vehicles, et cetera. And that's kind of like the new mindset of planners and engineers today, is to try to design for the throughput of everyone and not just the throughput of cars.
On Maryland Morning WYPR, I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Celeste Chavis, Assistant Professor of Transportation and Urban Infrastructure Studies at Morgan State School of Engineering, and with Gerald Neely, a former Baltimore City Transportation Planner. On Martin Luther King Day, we're talking about the wide boulevard named after him in Baltimore. Gerald Neely, you've written about this in the Baltimore Brew, possibilities of redeveloping the boulevard, but it's still, even as Professor Chavis described, going to be a broad stretch from one side of the boulevard to another. How does that actually connect the city more?
Yeah, I think the traffic is going to stay there. I don't think there's much you can do about that. And I think that narrowing it down is probably the best way to provide some relief. You know, it's always going to be difficult.
Narrowing it down by getting rid of the median, narrowing it down by getting rid of lanes of traffic.
Yeah, just as she said, there's a lot of you know, extra space. You could definitely narrow down the median, which is just dead space. And then the right turn lanes aren't used very much. The left turn lanes, which is where you have to wait for the traffic in the opposite direction, those lanes are very well used. But the right turn lanes, which are pretty much free flow, some of them are really, you know, overly free flow. We could get rid of those.
But if you narrow it down, then you're not going to move the buildings closer together that are now on either side. So what does that streamlined land become?
There's a lot of empty space. There's a lot of still leftover parcels from when the original expressway plan was devised, and they're just sort of, they made them into parkland, but it doesn't really relate to anything else. You know, it's green space, but it doesn't belong to anybody. It's not a people place. That's basically what you need, is to convert it into something that's a people place.
And how would you do that?
And that requires good design. The parkland from block to block needs to relate to the other blocks, make it more of a linear park, where you say you would jog along the whole length or ride your bike along the whole length in the parkland.
Professor Chavis, do you think MLK Boulevard would be built today?
Yes, probably.
Really?
I just think it's such an important connector between Baltimore and D.C. for people who are leaving the D.C. area and coming into Baltimore, that it probably would be built differently, but there would be some major road letting off of the 395 highway, allowing vehicles into the downtown and northern areas of the city.
And do you envision that Baltimore would be stuck with this divide you've talked about between downtown and West Baltimore?
I think it would be done in a much smarter way today than what it was done prior to. So there would still definitely be a major corridor for vehicles. Probably would have been a bit smaller, maybe not as many lanes, depending on how the planning was done. But it is a vital link, I believe, for the city.
The traffic on Martin Luther King Boulevard may divide people. It also attracts some people. For panhandlers, it can be a resource. Here's James, who told us he's homeless.
I've been on the street roughly a year now. I comes up here to Martin Luther King, you know, every day just about, and I try to you know, make ends meet, whatever I can get. You know, people help me out, give me a dollar or two here or there. And, you know, some people, it's surprising. You would think more people would help you. But, you know, some people, they got it messed up out here so bad that people don't want to help you anymore, you know?
Gerald Neely, in your view, does MLK Boulevard reflect the values that Dr. King stood for, like civil rights and economic equality?
Well, it's a physical barrier, much more than a racial barrier, I think. I think it is what it is. It's just this huge wide thing with huge amounts of traffic going back and forth. And that is, in my mind at least, separate from the racial issues in Baltimore. There are lots of other barriers and streets and things in Baltimore that are more racial barriers. Sometimes it's both physical and racial. For example, West Baltimore Street, west of Martin Luther King Boulevard, is much more white south of Baltimore Street than it is north of Baltimore Street. That constitutes more of a racial barrier with all the sociological issues. Martin Luther King Boulevard, in a way, is actually an easier problem to solve because it's a physical problem. It's just designing the streetscape in order to fulfill people's needs, you know, which is easier than actually, you know, getting into the content of people's character, as Martin Luther King did.
Professor Chavis, how do you think this boulevard connects or doesn't connect to Dr. King's legacy?
From the transportation standpoint, a lot has kind of moved towards making sure that we design for everyone. So making sure the person who doesn't have a car has the same access as someone who does have a car. So these major streets like MLK kind of show kind of the work that we still need to do in our field, where we do need to make sure that we invest evenly. So we're not just investing in cars, or we're not just investing in transit for those who are working downtown. So in a very micro scale, it kind of does show what work still needs to be done, I think, for the city.
I appreciate your thoughts. Thank you. Thank you both.
Good answer.
Thank you.
Gerald Neely is a former Baltimore City transportation planner. Celeste Chavis is an assistant professor in the Transportation and Urban Infrastructure Studies Department in the Morgan State University School of Engineering. The 15th annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Parade down the boulevard begins at noon today. It steps out at Utah Street and heads south to Saratoga. We've got a link to more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also links to Gerald Neely's thoughts about MLK Boulevard in the online news site, The Baltimore Brew. I'm Sheila Cass. There's more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay tuned to 88.1.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. Happy holiday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to the January edition of Living Questions, our monthly series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Today, on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, a conversation about the nonviolence movement with one of the founders of Jonah House, a community whose pillars are nonviolence, resistance, and community. Jonah House was founded in 1973 by Elizabeth McAllister, a former Catholic nun, and her husband, Philip Berrigan, a former Catholic priest who was a member of the Baltimore Four and the Catonsville Nine. In 1968, Catonsville 9 burned draft records as a protest against the Vietnam War, setting off a series of draft board protests around the country. I'm here today with Elizabeth McAllister at Jonah House, which is located at St. Peter's Cemetery in West Baltimore. Elizabeth McAllister, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Take us back to 1973, and you and your husband founded this community. What were your aspirations back then?
We had come out of years of resistance to the war in Vietnam, and we had recently been through the Harrisburg conspiracy trial in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and we realized in the midst of that trial that people who did draft board actions, and by the way, they started with Phil and Tom Lewis and a couple of others, doing an action at the Customs House here in Baltimore, pouring blood on draft records. And he was sentenced to 6 years in prison based on that. And then the Catonsville Nine occurred, and that was even more celebrated. And the two charges came together, and he served prison time he served 39 months of a 6-year sentence at that point. But they were the beginnings of a whole series of draft board actions. In taking action, people always talked about stepping into a life of resistance. And I believe people were very sincere about that, but we didn't have a clue what it meant. Nobody much had a clue what it meant. And as we went through the Harrisburg trial, we realized that most of the people who had done those actions had moved on in their lives and were elsewhere. And that we hadn't learned enough about sustaining resistance, and that the formula for that had to be in something like community. So the notion of forming community and basing it on nonviolence and resistance and community seemed to be, if not the answer, it's a road to something like an answer. So after a year of preparation, we moved to Baltimore and began here.
So these three pillars that you refer to, nonviolence, resistance, and community, they really are interdependent. One relies on the other.
I think that's very true. Yeah. I don't think you can sustain. You can do resistance periodically, but you can't sustain it.
How has the nonviolence movement, in your view, changed and evolved since the time that you founded Jonah House, back in the 70s?
Well, I think that where we see it most lived out is with many of the Catholic worker communities who do live not only nonviolence and community, but also resistance and poverty, you know, simple lifestyle and poverty. And a powerful amount of intercooperation is involved in that. And one of the things that has come out of all of that, aside from the whole series of plowshares actions, has been this Witness Against Torture group. Back in 2007, I think, the group went down to Cuba and walked to Guantanamo and had a fast and vigil as close to the prison as they could get. And ever since have had this consistent presence every January for the closing of Guantanamo. And the resistance and the nonviolence and the prayer life and the sense of community there is really, really intense. And I've been doing some thinking about Martin Luther King and thinking especially of the powerful community that surrounded him and how that hasn't been held up, I think, in recent years. You know, I think of Vincent Harding, who literally wrote the speech that Martin Luther King gave at Riverside. I think of Bayard Rustin, who did most of the organizing, you know, around the bus boycott.
The Riverside speech, we should remind folks, was about the Vietnam War.
Yes. Martin Luther King changed one sentence in that whole speech, and otherwise, that was the work of Vincent Harding. Now, that's incredible humility on the part of Harding. And, you know, I think of Harry Belafonte and the way that he supported this whole movement. And I guess seeing Selma and this movie where they can't even quote him, because the family owns these talks, is, in my view, an incredible violation of that powerful sense of community that existed there. Vincent Harding never claimed that speech. And Bayard Rustin wasn't looking for kudos from anybody. He just wanted to do what he could do. And Harry Belafonte continued to give and to give and to give and to be present, even though he couldn't even be present at Mrs. King's funeral because the Bushes were there. And there's a lot that's very, very mungy in all of this for me, and I hope we can all learn a little bit from it.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. You're listening to our series on religion and ethics called Living Questions. My guest this morning, Liz McAllister, one of the founders of Jonah House, a nonviolent community in West Baltimore. And of course, the fissures in the nonviolent movement began, even in Dr. King's lifetime, it began in a way with that Riverside speech, because people mm-hmm. were saying, why are you worrying about the Vietnam War? Go back to civil rights. Yes. Have those fissures, it seems like they have continued. And I wonder, is there a place that it's being taken up? For example, is the Occupy movement a successor to the civil rights and to the nonviolence movements of the 60s and 70s?
I thought Occupy had a lot of hope connected with it. I don't see it continuing. You see little uplifts of it, but I don't see it being what people hoped it would be. I was in great admiration for those who gave so much of their time and their lives and their sweat and discomfort. I mean, this is not a comfortable way to live, camping out. And there they were in the cities and repeatedly being arrested. And in Oakland, they suffered hugely, you know, and elsewhere. But I didn't in any way see that as a follow-up to the movement that Martin Luther King was so responsible for continuing to build on. And I really don't see that being picked up on. As I say, what I see and relate to is the Catholic workers and that resistance, and focusing on the war and focusing on the weapons and tying in with the black communities that have suffered so much at the hands of police. And that's a reality. That's a reality, and we know it.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that the recent situations in Ferguson and Staten Island and Cleveland will reinvigorate then that movement? It certainly has very much, you know, gotten involved mm-hmm. a lot more people in mm-hmm. protests. Yes. Do you think it could perhaps reinvigorate the nonviolent movement in particular?
Well, I want to refer to an amazing black woman named Ruby Sales, who has a peace group down. She's centered in Columbus, Georgia. And it's called Spirit House. And she organized an action in D.C. before the killings out in, well, Ferguson had happened, but the New York killing had not happened. But she had names of 1,000 young African-Americans killed by police since 2007. And in the course of that witness, we read all those 1,000 names. She has been involved all her life, and at age 17, and probably now she's 60s, 70s, but at age 17, she was doing voter registration down in Mississippi and was arrested with a group of people. They were held a number of days and then just thrown out of jail, as is pretty typical in the middle of the summer. So they called. I guess they found a phone and put in a call to their support people, but waiting, they were thirsty and went into this corner store for a cold drink. And she was standing in front of Jonathan Daniels, a seminarian from New Hampshire who had been down working with them, and a humongous cop, a sheriff's deputy, is standing there with his shotgun. And he says to her, I'm going to blow your brains out. And with that, she felt a hand on her shoulder, and Jonathan Daniels took the bullet and was killed. She was mute. She was mute until she testified at that trial as to what had happened. But she has continued from that day to this, since she's in her 70s and can barely walk at this point.
And when did that horrible incident take place?
That incident, I would guess 50s.
Yeah. 50s.
Mm-hmm.
One, of course, the fundamental tenets of a nonviolent life is that violence is never an appropriate response
to anything.
How do you answer those folks who say, but we live in a violent world, we have the Islamic State, mm-hmm. ISIS, Boko mm-hmm. Haram, we have violence being perpetrated, you know, in Paris and against innocents all over the world, Nigeria. Yeah. How does one confront violence without violence?
You take it. And if it means your death, you take that too, as Jonathan Daniels did. And he was down there, a white seminarian from New Hampshire. And they loved him. They loved him because he embodied it. He embodied what they were trying to learn, and he was trying to learn. We're always trying to learn it, and we all fail sometimes. But you try to learn from those mistakes.
If you had the chance to speak to the head of ISIS or Boko Haram, what would you say? How would you try to be persuasive to that person to stop the violence that mm-hmm. person so obviously embraces?
Mm-hmm. I think I would ask them to look back on what it's accomplishing in their countries, among their people, and in their own hearts. And if they think they're better now than they were when they got into it. And that kind of reflection is absolutely essential. And it's got to happen every single day, you know.
Elizabeth McAllister is one of the founders of Jonah House, a faith-based community of people who have for more than 40 years advanced the notion of nonviolence as a way of life. We've got a link to more information about Jonah House on our website, as well as a link to information about a book written by Frida Berrigan, one of Liz McAllister's three children. It's called It Runs in the Family, on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. Frida Berrigan and I will be talking about that book on an upcoming program, but you can catch a sneak peek and hear other conversations in our Living Questions series when you come over to wypr.org/livingquestions. That's it for this edition of Living Questions, our monthly series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. The series is produced by WYPR in conjunction with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Reporting from West Baltimore on 88.1, I'm Tom Hall.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has been to see Other Desert Cities, now up at the Fells Point Corner Theater. She brings us this review.
A well-to-do, high-powered Republican husband and wife, former Hollywood royalty, welcome their grown daughter home for the holidays. It's the first time she's been back since suffering a breakdown. They've also taken in the wife's sister, a recovering alcoholic. And their holiday is haunted by memories of their elder son, who committed suicide years earlier. But in John Robin Bates's play, Other Desert Cities, what threatens to tear this family apart isn't any one of those issues. It's something new. Brooke, the daughter, has written a family memoir focusing on her brother's death. Not only has the book been accepted for publication, but The New Yorker is about to publish an excerpt. Brooke apparently doesn't say kind things about her parents in the memoir, and yet she's hoping for their blessing.
You could postpone the magazine piece so I could slowly persuade your mother that it doesn't matter. Brooke, I'm looking for room to navigate. For this to feel less like we are cornered, you have to give people room to navigate. You must leave people options.
Politics has given you the idea that all things are negotiable, Lyman. It's why people can't bear politics anymore. Everything is forever on the table.
This has nothing to do with politics. I'm frightened. In 2 months, the most painful part of our lives will be in the glossy pages of a magazine, and then a few months later, a book.
At Fells Point Corner Theater, where Other Desert Cities is receiving an absorbing Baltimore premiere, Laura Malkus's intensity as Brooke is balanced by Dave Gamble's gentle, diplomatic spirit as her father, Lyman. Like most of John Robin Bates's plays, Other Desert Cities has a strong political undercurrent. Lyman is a former movie star who went on to chair the Republican Party. His wife, a former screenwriter, has supported him with all the ardor of Nancy Reagan, her friend and idol. Their son's suicide was tied to a violent act protesting the Vietnam War. And Brooke and her aunt, played by Linda Chambers, carry his standard as staunch liberals. There's a certain amount of speechifying tied to the character's political and personal agendas. Just about everybody gets a chance to launch into a meaty monologue or two. But it is a credit to Bates's playwriting and Michael Zemmerl's fervent direction that you get caught up in the storytelling in these speeches, not in rhetoric. Storytelling and the ability to separate fact from fiction is a central theme in this 2011 Broadway play. Brooke wants to unearth family truths in her memoir, a book that helped draw her out of her nervous breakdown and writer's block. But the thing about family truths and memoirs is that everyone remembers things differently. Add to that a couple of major secrets, and Other Desert Cities is part mystery, part family drama, part political debate, but mostly an examination of the lies, half-truths, and buried secrets that color a family's history. Allegiances shift in the play, along with the record that Brooke is determined to set straight and commit to paper. Though she'd deny it, she turns out to have a lot in common with her unbending, tough-love mother, portrayed with a will of flint by Linda McCleary. Brooke expects to find an ally in her younger brother, a reality TV producer imbued with a laid-back, West Coast vibe by David Shoemaker. Too young to really remember his brother or the circumstances surrounding his death, Shoemaker's character is the only member of the family capable of distancing himself and achieving perspective.
The trouble with being good at things is that it takes too much work to stay good at them.
With that attitude, it's a miracle you finished your book.
My book. What happens if they hate it?
They've never hated anything you've written.
I just get the sense it's not going to be so easy. I was kidding myself. It's so much pressure.
Look, it's not like you've written some poor little Hollywood upbringing thing, is it?
The play's title, Other Desert Cities, refers specifically to a road sign on the way to the family home in Palm Springs. Obliquely, it refers to the war that Brooke's parents support in a desert far from their comfortable California home, a home stunningly realized on stage by set designer Bush Greenbeck. Emotion is not recollected in tranquility in this household. It's precarious but rewarding territory, skillfully explored at Fells Point Corner Theater.
Other Desert Cities is up at the Fells Point Corner Theater through February 8th. We've got a link to more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. After the news, we remember when Coretta Scott King came to Baltimore. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. 50 years ago, in the mid-1960s, Martin Luther King Jr. was drawing his movement's attention from civil rights to economic justice. The rights of the working poor cut across racial divides for King and his wife, Coretta Scott King. They saw the civil rights movement as intertwined with the work of unions to raise wages and improve working conditions. In the 1960s, African Americans were moving into cities as jobs and factories were moving elsewhere. Here's Dr. King in March 1968.
For most of the poverty-stricken people in our country are working every day, but they are making wages so inadequate that they cannot begin to function in the mainstream of economic life of the nation. They are working in many instances full-time jobs for part-time income.
When Dr. King was assassinated a month later, he was in Memphis, Tennessee, organizing his Poor People's Campaign and preparing for a march with striking sanitation workers. Just days after his death, his widow led a march in Memphis with those workers. And a year later, continuing her work on the Poor People's Campaign, she came to Baltimore to speak to the Hospital and Nursing Home Employees Union, Local 1199E, which was seeking the right to represent hospital workers. Producer Jonna McCone picks up the story.
Johns Hopkins Hospital in East Baltimore, even in the 1960s, was one of the best hospitals in the nation. And organizers working to improve the conditions of African Americans in the city felt a place known for its innovative medical practices should also lead the way in fair wages. To understand the connection between the civil rights and workers' rights movements here in Baltimore, I spoke with longtime activist Bob Moore, who was awarded an Unsung Hero of the Civil Rights Movement Award by the City of Baltimore Community Relations Commission in 2000. I also sat down with two members of the 1199 Union, Annie Henry and Laura Pugh, who met Coretta Scott King in the late 1960s. Bob Moore starts our story.
I'm Bob Moore, born in Baltimore over 70 years ago now. As a kid growing up in Baltimore, I was painfully aware of segregation and racism. When I was about 12, 13, I went with a white friend whose father owned a garage. We went to the white coffee pot. We both jumped on the counter, and then I was asked to get down. He thought it meant him too, but the waitress said, "No, hon, you can stay. He just can't not sit at the counter." Great French fries, but my mother later, when I was trying to clearly understand, chastised me for going into a place you weren't welcome in. I became, I guess, a full-time activist in the summer of 1964. It was a group of SDS, or Students for Democratic Society chapter at Hopkins and Goucher. We formed a thing called the Union for Jobs. Certainly, without jobs, freedom is kind of a hollow thing.
My name is Laura Pugh. I live in Northeast Baltimore. I worked at Hopkins, John Hopkins, for 40 years there. I am retired. 1199 involves in hospitals and nursing homes. They are throughout East Baltimore, West Baltimore, everywhere.
1199 had developed an ongoing relationship with Dr. King, and after his assassination, the relationship continued with SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Originally was Dr. King's, was the head of the organization. And after King's assassination, I guess the union proposed to continue Dr. King's work on what had become his anti-poverty initiatives. To serve that mission, the union agreed to help lead a campaign to organize hospital workers. When the union came to Baltimore, the Baltimore riots had sort of changed the atmosphere in the city in many ways.
My name is Annie M. Henry. I have been employed at Johns Hopkins for 45 years. The job that I do now, I've had it at least 43 years. I come from a union family. My father worked at Sparrows Point for years, and he was a union man. That was in 1969 when the union came. I'd been employed at Hopkins for 6 months. I started there in April the 24th, 1969. And by that December, when the union came, I was ready to go because it was not a nice place to work. A lot of prejudices, a lot of hateful, mean things going on.
We only went in certain doors, and that was Rutland Avenue. We were not allowed to go in the front door, the back, all those doors. And that was housekeeping, nutrition, escort services, and engineering. And that meant that we couldn't go up on the first floor. They didn't want us up there. This is the way it was, and you didn't change it because of this is the way it was. We wore yellow and white uniforms and nurses' shoes. You had to be clean. Everything had to be clean on you in order to work at Hopkins.
A lot of the managers and supervisors, they were very disrespectful, and they assumed because you were doing a menial job that you were an ignorant person, and that's not the case. Once the union came, it was a raise. You could see a few pennies. It wasn't dollars. You could see a few pennies. It was better than what we were making at the time.
Coretta was co-chairman, or Coretta Scott King was co-chair of what was the 1199 National Organizing Committee.
We got to go see her on our lunch break, and you had to take your lunch break, and you had to be back on time. But she spoke about nonviolence. She spoke about standing up for our rights. She spoke about women stepping to the plate.
So people swarmed out the doors of Hopkins Hospital greeting her. Hospital management people stood on a second floor window peering down, but never thought sense enough to come out.
When Coretta Scott King came, it was a lot of excitement. She spoke about her husband, Dr. Martin Luther King, and she said that we was his favorite union, and, you know, this union held a special place in her heart. And she talked about how we, with the management, could try to make it a better working conditions. And at times, when she could, and her bodyguards and whatnot allowed her, she would come through the audience and, you know, shake people's hands and ask questions and whatnot. When they took the union vote, I hollered, I screamed, I prayed, I did everything. I was so happy that the union was able to get in John Hopkins.
1970, I was 19 years old, and I made $2.10 an hour. I would bring home $52 a week. And I learned that through this union. You know, we have to be together. If we work hard, then we should be paid hard money. In 2014, they were able to raise their wages past poverty. Now, that's how long it took them, from 1970 to 2014.
That was Annie Henry, who still works at Hopkins Hospital, Laura Pugh, she retired in 2010, and Bob Moore, who's working on a memoir.
That story was produced by Maryland Morning's Jonna McCone. We reached out to Johns Hopkins for comment, but did not hear back before airtime.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein
and Catherine Sway.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1809, Edgar Allan Poe was born in Boston. He died 40 years later in a Baltimore hospital. We're back Wednesday. Join us then.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're @MarylandMorning.